Since 2007, nearly 4,000 calls from Kentucky have been made to the National Human Trafficking Hotline. And in 2022 alone, Kentucky received 344 reports of human trafficking involving 399 child victims. So what's contributing to the rise in human trafficking, and what can be done to stop what should be unthinkable in the Commonwealth of Kentucky and across our nation? You're tuned into the Commonwealth Matters, and I'm Richard Nelson, founder and executive director of the Commonwealth Policy Center. Joining us to talk further about this topic of human trafficking is Dr. Jean Allard, the founder of Institute of Shelter Care, a training and equipping entity to help establish new shelter programs for women and children caught in human trafficking. Jean, you and I met with a mutual friend the other day, and we were talking about some of the changing cultural dynamics, particularly in the digital and media realm. It got me thinking that we need to do another program, because you were just on here recently and we had a really good program, positive feedback on it. But there were elements of human trafficking that we really didn't get to, and things that I did not consider. And that's why you're back. So it is so good to have you join us again. So Jean, I guess we'll start with this. Today, here we are, early 2024, very much different than it was 10, 15, even 20 years ago. And I'm thinking in the context of the media environment, or the communications digital realm that we have stepped in. 20 years ago, we didn't have smartphones. Social media wasn't even invented yet. People weren't on the internet like they are today. So the media, digital connectivity realm has radically changed in these past 20 years, and has probably affected children more than anyone. But along those lines, in related to human trafficking, what are some other broad stroke changes that you've seen in these past 20 years? In fact, human trafficking, I guess maybe I'll step back a little further and say that 20 years ago, human trafficking wasn't in our vocabulary. Was it? Maybe we'll start with there. When did human trafficking, as we understand it today, when did that come into our vocabulary? And then second of all, let's talk about some of the changes that you've seen in the past 10 to 20 years or so.
Yeah, I just did a 25-year retrospective on sort of the evolution of awareness and intervention with human trafficking here in America. And we looked keenly at the role that technology has played, let's say, as an enabler and an accelerator to some of the sociological phenomenon that we're now dealing with. But to answer your question about when did this even become a topic on our radar, we go back to 2000, which was the first Trafficking in Persons Act. And so that was what was happening at a federal legislative level. But at that time, it wasn't on the public consciousness. It was largely looking at transnational activity. And if we had any mindset about it at all, we were thinking of it in terms of, oh, those people over there, or people who were going to other nations to do bad things. Then we saw a shift in 2010 when the State Department made a pivotal move and they issued the Trafficking in Persons report, the TIP report. And for years, they had produced this document, but they hadn't, as they evaluated the trafficking offenses globally, they hadn't included the U.S. In 2010, they included the U.S. for the first time. And so we put ourselves under the same scrutiny and we realized we have a problem domestically. But I would say that popular culture has also been an accelerant to public consciousness, because between 2010 and 2015, we saw initiatives at the federal level, like the Blue Campaign, and certain initiatives where we started to do rescue and restore coalitions or task forces. But then when we had films like Taken, or most recently Sound of Freedom, those also are sources that have kind of added fuel to the conversational flame, if you will. So that's a real quick, like, bring us up to the present.
No, that's good. So in 2010, I want to go back to this Trafficking in Persons report. In 2010, the United States was included in that report. So really, as far as domestic human trafficking, this is only an issue that's 14 years old. Is that fair to say?
Oh, I would say it's even more refined than that, because even though the TIP report looked at the United States in terms of how do we rank in terms of trafficking offenses, it didn't have a, let's call it a domestic accountability piece to it. That we saw those changes happen more around 2015, when the first Office of Domestic Trafficking was established in HHS. And then even more pronounced in 2019, when that administration put a position in the Office of Domestic Policy that reported directly to the White House, that was to look specifically at trafficking within the United States borders. And so over time, we have gone from, yes, we have a problem, to let's put it within a government agency. But the reason it was a little different between the 2010s and towards the end of that decade was because when we first put it in the federal agencies, it was largely still focused under, it was positioned under the Office of Refugee Resettlements in HHS. And so you can just know by virtue of where it was placed, how we were looking at the problem. The population must be immigrants, refugees, migrants, et cetera. When that moved in 19 to report directly to the White House as a domestic policy issue, that was a clear demarcation that said, this is a problem for American citizens.
Jean, do we have any idea, and that's really good background information to help us understand how the government initially thought of this, that it was a refugee immigrant issue, and then we discovered that really it's a domestic issue. Do we have any idea how much of that trafficking is from abroad? Of course, we hear, you know, one of the big stories these days is what's going on at our southern border, that the border is porous, that young children are being trafficked. We do know that that's true. But do we have any idea of how the percentage of trafficked young people or women that are illegal immigrants or refugees compared to the domestic population?
No, the numbers are incredibly elusive and the crime is so under the radar. I think one of the things that has been helpful for the movement is, and if you think of it being positioned under ORR, we were still also very much thinking of human trafficking from a labor trafficking perspective. And that had to bifurcate to say, well, labor trafficking functions very differently than sex trafficking. And so now what you'll see in the movement is there are people who are attending to the issue from a labor trafficking perspective, for which we have to take into consideration the foreign nationals. They may have come into this country for the purposes of economic opportunity, employment, et cetera. But the sex trafficking wake-up call for us was that was largely our own citizens against our own citizens.
So lest somebody tuned into this program right now might think that this is an issue internationally or just at the national level in the big cities, this is an issue here in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. The Kentucky Attorney General's office has a, I believe, a task force that is looking into this and engaging this issue. I think you've been involved with that to some degree, either consulting or engaging it. But going back to a statistic that I just shared at the beginning of the program, it was 399 child victims who were trafficked in Kentucky in 2022 alone. I don't have last year's numbers, but this is an increase. There's a clear rise in trafficking across the nation and here in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Tell us about your efforts here in the Commonwealth, particularly, and I hope I didn't get ahead of myself and say anything about, that I shouldn't have about the Attorney General's office. I think that's fairly public as far as your involvement there. I'm not sure if that is, so I apologize if I let the cat out of the bag.
No, but I'll amplify that to say that our new Attorney General also has appointed a gentleman who came out of state police, and he is specifically designated to look at counter-exploitation. And so that's a much larger term, inclusive of the ways in which pornographic images are used to exploit individuals. And so it's a good framing. I think it's very intelligent the way that they have positioned it, not make it so narrow to a particular statute, but to say the exploitation and counter exploitation is his role. So yes, there is a task force, there's dedicated efforts on that. And we do, of course, have federal agents who are placed here in this state, as they are across the United States, to work on issues of trafficking and exploitation.
Jean, when we got together over coffee the other day, you had shared with me the nature of child predators or where they're looking for victims. It's much different than 20 years ago, before social media and before cell phones, where you could have somebody that would go to a playground and look for children and entice them away. But now they don't have to do that. Tell us more of what's happening there. That just, it stunned me. And it really forced me to think in a different way about what's going on today, the landscape, and how things have changed and made children more vulnerable than they've ever been.
Sure. So because we started with a little bit of history, let's also make sure that we kind of have the building blocks of conversation as we go forward. And for your visual listeners, you can just follow my diagram. But for your auditory listeners, just picture a triangle. And we have to think of trafficking, the actors in that enterprise, as being one of the three points on a triangle. And so using classic economic language, you have demand, you have supply, and then you have a facilitator. And in sort of crass, generalized terms, in the realm of sex trafficking, you have somebody who has a demand. They want a service. They want something. Now, because of 20 years ago or longer, lack of access, lack of opportunity, maybe social mores, maybe economics, getting to supply was harder. And so you needed a facilitator to basically broker access to the supply. So if you think of it in the sort of transnational sex trafficking sense, if my proclivity is I want to molest a four-year-old boy, then I have to find a broker who will find me that boy, let's say in Thailand, and I will then, he will set that up for me, right? And so that's how I get access to the supply. Now, the reason that that triangle is so important for us is we have to realize that there's a power dynamic that happens across this triangle based on who has what the other person wants, right? So the facilitator wants the demand's money, the demand wants the supply, but he needs the facilitator. And so that's how we have understood this trade. But what's been interesting over the last several years is that many of our law enforcement efforts have gone after, okay, we've got to go after the facilitators, you might say the pimps, the traffickers. We have to go after them. And so law enforcement, rightly so, that's been their focus. Domestically, our focus has not been on demand at all, even though that's the originator of the transaction. And then certainly in the non-governmental space, the nonprofits, the church world, we've put our focus on the victim side, on the supply side. But to your point about how has that changed over the years, think of technology as the accelerator, but also the disintermediator, because a couple of the technologies along this last 20 years that have really shaped that triangle would be something as straightforward as the iPhone. The iPhone had a tremendous impact on trafficking because it not only put a ubiquitous device, right, in everybody's hands that had a camera, but also tracking capabilities. That was extraordinarily good from the supply perspective because they could use the camera to advertise. It was very good from the facilitator's perspective because they could use that as a monitoring tool, right? I'm keeping track of my girls by the camera, the tracking, etc. But it was also good from a demand perspective because it opened them up to the opportunity to be able to have the visual piece, right? To have more direct communications. Law enforcement liked the iPhone because they could collect digital evidence. Traffickers liked the iPhones. Supply were using it. And so that was a technology that really fueled this industry. But what it also began to do is we started seeing other technologies. And I'll give you a few that might surprise you, but back in the day when we had Craigslist and Backpage, those were technology platforms on the web that changed the way we do commerce, right? So now if you want to buy some boutique racing bicycle, you don't have to go through a store You don't have to go to a facilitator. You can go direct to another consumer. You see what I mean? You could just go into a community of bicycle aficionados and say, hey, this is what I'm looking for. So platforms like that, that changed the way commerce happened, opened up the transaction between demand and supply directly and began to disintermediate the need for facilitator. That phenomenon has accelerated. So when we look at some platforms now, like OnlyFans and TikTok and my goodness, the camming sites and sugaring sites and all of these different ways, it is now direct demand to supply.
We are going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Hi, my name is Richard Nelson, founder and executive director of the Commonwealth Policy Center. We're here to shore up the sanctity of human life, religious freedom, natural marriage, and sound fiscal policies. At the Commonwealth Matters, we have conversations with leading thinkers and policymakers to help us think biblically about the great issues of the day. If you appreciate our work, then please consider a donation today. This work is entirely supported by people just like you. Your gifts and tax-deductible contributions help to underwrite this program, and you help to get this important message out all across the Commonwealth. We believe that the Commonwealth of Kentucky is a great place to live, and we want to keep it that way for our families and our children. That's why we're standing for what's right, for what's good, and what's true right here in Kentucky. Thanks in advance for your support, and may God bless you. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson here with Dr. Gene Allert. We're talking about child trafficking and human trafficking of women in the Commonwealth of Kentucky and across the country. And Gene, one of the things that we like to do at the Commonwealth Policy Center is to help people connect the dots and understand that things as sad as child trafficking don't just come out of the blue. It's not just something that it wasn't here, and the next day it is. I think there have been a number of things that have led to this. We're talking about the changes in technology, but really, you had just mentioned that the change in technology, which was pornography, was printed and it was sold in a certain part of town. There was a certain element of effort that went into that, and then a certain element of risk that went into that. Today, if you have a smartphone or have access to the computer, it is at your fingertips, and kids can access this, and not just access it, but they become vulnerable once they're identified as children.
No, it's pushed directly to them. Yeah, it's pushed directly to them. They don't even have to go look for it. I'll give you a visual, and this is quite some years ago, but back when we were concerned about the access of children being able to access pornography, there were sites, I'll describe one in particular, where you could go to a webpage and you could download coloring pages for Easter. And so you think, well, that's a nice homeschool activity, right? I'm going to download these pieces of paper that my, you know, toddler can go ahead and color leading up to Easter. But it was all a front, that if you clicked on any of these images, it immediately went into pornographic material. And so if you had made the mistake of sitting your child down to say, pick out the pages that you want to color, there was a big risk. And that was all a ruse to begin to put this content in front of children. Now we have to understand with things like sexting that is happening with the kids and the sextortion. But even through some of the technologies that they, you know, have, there is, like the video games, for example, there is a very intentional programming to put content in front of children. I think it would be fascinating for any of your listeners to just consider, what did a cartoon look like 30 years ago? And now let's look at what avatars or what even some of the sort of cartoon bot characters look like online. And what you will see, and there are people, social scientists, who've done a thoughtful study of how what we've done over these few decades is radically exaggerate physical features to the point where they almost look not normal. And part of that is because we we attenuate or we begin to become numb to certain stimuli. So we have to increase the stimuli in order to have the same dopamine response. And so what they're doing is they're doing that visually. And so now you see these people who they're not even people, these renderings of what should be people that are so extreme and exaggerated that what we have to also anticipate is that if from a pornography perspective, which is a drug, that I begin to believe that this is what a human being looks like, how they function, right, how they respond, then I become acclimated to that. And that separates me from the connection with actual humans. And I mean to be dramatic with that, because one area that is on the rise for us are the sex dolls and the sex bots, actual robots. And they are constructed in very abnormal proportions.
Very disturbing. There are documentaries out there regarding sex bots that are very realistic. Here in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, a bill just passed, as we're doing this program earlier today, a bill that would ban child sex dolls.
Can you believe you even have to say those words?
I can't. And it's disturbing. Look, just child sex doll. Disturbing. It's disturbing that somebody came up with this idea. It's disturbing that there's a market for it. But fortunately, we have legislators that are standing in the gap, and they're saying, look, this leads to child predation. This leads to the sexual abuse of children and pedophilia. And this makes the point of what I tried to explain earlier about connecting the dots. Human trafficking didn't come out of the blue. It starts with pornography. Of course, pornographers figured out how to airbrush the women and make them more appealing. And then you have digital technology. Gene, you just mentioned the exaggeration of features in cartoons. We have all of these different elements going on. It's almost like we're in a superstorm, if you will. You know, misplaced desires, boundaries that are skewed between adults and children, sex taken out of marriage. I know there's a lot there, but my head is spinning. And I guess what kicked it off was the child sex dolls. Can't comprehend it. But perhaps that alone and the necessity of this legislation should be a fire alarm in all of our minds as to what's going on. What's going on in our culture and what can I do? And that's what I want to move towards. Do we have some practical advice for parents who their kids, maybe they've got a teenager, middle schooler, that has a cell phone, or they're active on TikTok and other social media. What are some practical things that parents can do to help protect their kids?
Your listeners need to understand, we have to fight on every battlefield. We have got to be able to say, I need to know what's on my kid's phone. I need to know who's in my child's circle of influence. I need to know who has relational access to my child. And that's everything from the old school, don't just drop your kid off at the ballpark and drive away, but you need to know. Parents have got to be much more vigilant. And I'm not being hyperbolic. It's a very different time than when I was raising mine. And so we have got to understand that we have, by virtue of the good things about technology, opened our children up to every predator in the globe. Not just creepy person down the street, not just unhealthy person within our own family, but everyone in the globe. And they can, in one form or another, speak into how your child's worldview is formed. And so we have to be very mindful of that, whether that's something like if your kid just plays video games all day long, you have to anticipate that your child's worldview is the world is under my control. And people do what I make them do. And that's a worldview. And that we're seeing that now being played out with the bots. Because I can program that sex bot to talk to me the way I want, respond the way I want, look the way I want. And that is rewiring our perceptions and the way we interact with one another.
Gene, if I could jump in and say that when you spend anybody, whether it's a child or an adult, is spending an inordinate amount of time on a screen, either gaming or on social media sites, they have less opportunity to have real relationship with people. You mentioned the sex bot. If somebody's programming this a machine to act in a certain way, to do certain things, that person is not having a real relationship with a person. In essence, this technology misused is making us less human. It is making us less capable of developing relationships, makes us more vulnerable to being exploited. It coarsens us and allows us to do things that were unthinkable. So I'm really glad that you brought up the worldview dynamic. And essentially, we're talking about the dehumanization of people. And I find it so ironic where we have technology has been used for good in many instances. But in this case, we're letting technology change us and shape us for the worse. I'm glad to say this. I mentioned a piece of legislation a few minutes ago. Another piece of legislation regarding social media use and minors in Kentucky is making its way through the state house. It would require minors to have parental permission before they get on various social media platforms. So we see this response at the legislative level, at least here in Kentucky, where there are efforts to protect children and their vulnerability.
Well, I know there's also been seemingly controversial arguments around children having cell phones in the schools. And when we need to understand that the school largely is not only where we expect our children to be prepared for life from a knowledge perspective, but largely from a socialization perspective. And I would be highly supportive of those devices not being allowed in school, because what I'm seeing in terms of the generation now coming up is that they are really quite deficit in their ability to navigate conflict, build cooperative relationships, do group work. We have disabled them in many ways. And I would say chiefly sociologically. So if you take that and you couple it with the devices that are advancing this dehumanization, we really are reaching a bit of that. Well, you called it a five-alarm fire. I'm just going to go full on dumpster fire.
Jean, we are out of time. This has been a fantastic conversation. Just want to thank you again for your work with Institute for Shelter Care. Appreciate your perspective. And I think we'll have to do another program in the future to get an update from you. And if you're just tuning in, again, you're listening to The Commonwealth Matters. Please, if you would, go to your favorite podcast platform and rate us. That greatly helps us if you could do that. And then secondly, tell your friends about us.